If you ask the average person how to remove the carbon dioxide that's driving global warming, they're probably going to say plant more trees. We all have that basic understanding that trees breathe in carbon dioxide to sustain themselves, and it's not wrong. But it's only part of the story. A lot of us aren't aware of what's happening below ground as part of this crucial life-sustaining process. If there's one farm solution out there that's also a climate solution, it's definitely soil carbon sequestration. And that's what we're going to talk about in this episode. I'm Derek Leahy, and this is Rural Routes to Climate Solutions. Okay, since soil carbon sequestration is a fairly complicated subject, and I don't really feel confident about talking about it all by myself, I brought in a very special guest today. Kim Cornish is the founder and executive director of Food Water Wellness Foundation, which is an organization that supports farmers in the building of truly viable local food systems that produce sustainable livelihoods, nutrient-rich foods, and environmental regeneration. Kim is also the creator of Rootstock, which is a festival celebrating Alberta food and drink and water, which leads me to my very first question. I read something on your website that Rootstock might be happening this year. Is it true?
We're working very hard to get sponsorship secured so that we can put on Rootstock this summer.
I've never actually been to Rootstock, so I'm going to be really upset if it doesn't happen.
Well, I will send you the sponsorship documents and maybe you can help distribute them.
This podcasting stuff doesn't pay very well. Kim's also, she also sits on the advisory committee of Rural Routes to Climate Solutions. And Kim just knows a ton about soil carbon sequestration. Now, Kim, you're more or less self-taught in a really complex subject. How did this come about?
Well, it really started about 10 years ago with my permaculture training. And when I did my initial PDC, permaculture design course, there was mention of soil carbon sequestration. And I was like, that's really interesting. And then through the development of Food Water Wellness Foundation, and our main goal being to promote practices and advance the practice of regenerative agriculture, I really started looking at ways that we can incentivize farmers to do regenerative agricultural practices. And then while I was talking to a lot of farmers that were doing those practices, they were mentioning things like, we've seen increases in our soil organic matter from 2% to 5%. And it was like, oh, that's a lot of carbon that you have drawn down. And so basically, I kind of went on this quest to figure out how we could measure soil carbon on individual farms and then potentially develop offsets around that. And so I just had to backfill all the scientific knowledge to make that a viable project.
It's super impressive. I know when we worked on it together, just what, I don't know, just the knowledge you have, it just kind of blows me away. So I'm very happy you're here because today, we're going to listen to a presentation that took place in Irakana. Kim actually organized this workshop for us. It was our carbon measurement workshop. It took place last October. Now, I love that workshop. I thought it was great. I don't know. How'd you find it?
It was really fun. It was a really fun day. It was a nice mix of some theory and some science. And we got out into the field and I actually got to like look at soil cores and see the environment where they were from. So it was, I always try to say that like I try to create workshops that are immersive experiences for people. And I feel like that kind of was that way.
Oh, totally. And plus your mom made very, very delicious lunch that day.
Shout out to Rini and Linda Ray and my auntie Norma for doing the catering for us. So
I think it's definitely the best catered event we've had so far. We had a really great presenters that day. Kim was actually one of them. And the other two presenters were Monica Gorzalak, who's a research scientist at Agricultural and Agri-Food Canada, and Doug Ray. Doug Ray is a rancher in Irakana. He's also the former chair of the Canadian Forage and Grasslands Association. The very first presentation we're going to listen to is the one Monica Gorzalak did on the process of soil carbon sequestration.
Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Kim, for inviting me here. I am, as Derek said, I am a soil fertility and nutrient management research scientist at Agriculture Canada in Lethbridge. And I literally just started, so this is my fourth week in the job, so I hereby declare myself as being the least experienced and kind of dumbest person in the room. So I'm really pleased to be here, and the reason I wanted to be here today was to learn from all of you, because indeed I don't have any experience in agriculture and I don't have any experience in prairie soils, so all of this is new to me and I'm learning lots. So why did I even get this job? I did my PhD in mycorrhizas. What Doug was saying, plants talking to each other, that was my PhD. So it was really nice to get a shout out. The thing I did for my PhD, I used Douglas fir, and I planted two Douglas fir together and allowed them to form a mycorrhizal network. And I was able to show that Douglas fir communicate, i.e. send carbon and nitrogen through the mycorrhizal network to each other. So what does that mean? We think it means plants are talking to each other, so that's the evidence. We've shown that we the grand scientific community, have shown that in for example, tomatoes. So in model systems, we can show that there's transfer through the fungi, right? So I think I'm probably preaching to the choir here about mycorrhizal fungi, but essentially what they are soil fungi that are symbiotic, and they form this really intimate relationship, like a physical structure within the roots that you can see through a microscope. And in the case of conifers, you can actually see, you can actually dig these up and they have, you can actually see the structures, the fungal hyphae, making caps on top of the root tips. And you can actually see them forming these strands in the soil in the forest. The idea and what we've thought for tens of years, I mean, we've known about mycorrhizas for a long time. The idea was that the mycorrhizas are able to penetrate deeper and further into the soil and acquire nutrients and exchange them with the plant for the photosynthase, so for, you know, the sugars that the plant is making. So we thought that was the case, and that is indeed the case. If you inoculate, you know, we've shown in studies that if you inoculate with mycorrhizal fungi, as compared to not mycorrhizal fungi, the plants usually do better because they're able to access more of those nutrients. But what we're now seeing is that there's a information highway in the soil. So if you don't disturb your soil, what you're doing is you're allowing those hyphae to make connections. And the plants can potentially send nutrients and or defense chemicals. So if there's a pest, a herbivore that eats one leaf, and we can actually block any other, you know, volatile organic chemicals are usually emitted when that happens. But if we block that, we can actually see a connected plant respond as though it had been herbivorized itself, right? So we have shown that there is transfer of defense chemicals through these mycorrhizal networks. So, I mean, I'm speaking about forestry systems, and that's my background, that's where I'm coming from. What I want to do in my new job, and what Agriculture Canada seemed to get fired up as well about, is doing this in crops. So doing this in perennial and annual systems. So something that I'm working on right now, a project I'm really excited about, and hopefully it'll get some money, is to do this in things like wheat, and to do this with things like wheat and wild oat, for example. So my question is, if you have weeds, is there nutrients that are moving out of the system because of the mycorrhizal network, right? If you have a no-till practice. So I'm interested in quantifying where these nutrients are moving and to see whether this applies to agriculture and agricultural systems. So that's what I'm really fired up about. The other reason I'm here today is Kim invited me because even before I started my job, I'd heard from Kim, who is interested in doing a project using the regenerative agriculture approaches, so the multi-paddock grazing. What I'm interested in becoming a part in joining this from the perspective of looking at the microbiology. So we know that with intensive management, we can increase soil organic carbon. And the thing that's doing that is the biology in the soil. So I'm interested in quantifying that. And I'm hopeful that what we can do is also create a tool, a genomics tool, that if folks are interested in being able to identify the communities of soil bacteria and soil fungi within their soils, we're hopeful that we can come up with a tool that would be useful to farmers. So that's something I'd love to talk to people about here, if that's something you're interested in, and what would you like to see in terms of the soil microbiology. Kim had also asked me to speak about the carbon cycle. So, I feel like, again, I'm the dumbest person in the room. So, quite simply, the carbon cycle is photosynthesis on the one hand, and then decomposition on the other hand. So CO2 goes in through photosynthesis, becomes sugar, becomes plant matter, and then that plant decomposes through microbes and releases CO2 again. The part that I want to focus on is the decomposition portion. So part of that sugar gets decomposed and gets eaten immediately. So that's your labile carbon that is going to be emitted as CO2 immediately. Some of that is going to become like lignin and cellulose, which are more recalcitrant. Simultaneously, those sugars that are being emitted through the root exudates that we discussed earlier are also feeding microbes. What creates a lot of the recalcitrant carbon within the system is the dead bodies of bacteria and fungi. So if the roots are feeding the bacteria, what you actually get is those bacteria are cycling and turning over. Bacteria are eating bacteria, fungi are eating bacteria, bacteria are eating fungi, and they're creating more and more biomass as they feed upon each other. So the more complex your root exudates with biodiversity above ground creates more biodiversity below ground. And the long-term carbon then is those cell walls, which are quite complicated structures, get bound to minerals and flocculate and create those soil aggregates, which slowly move and create depth in the soil and get locked deeper and deeper and longer in the soil. So that's in a nutshell, what I'm interested in. And I'm interested in understanding which of those organisms are doing what in the soils. So no-till is amazing. What I like a lot is cover crops. So anything that continues to grow is going to continue to put root exudates into the system. And that's key. So once something is not growing, it's not inputting photosynthate essentially into the system.
There's a whole suite of jugs of bacteria and fungi elixirs that people could purchase now. Mm-hmm. And lots of anecdotal photographs of before and after and across the fence kind of thing. But
sure.
I had one scientist tell me that he wouldn't be spending any money on that because it would be like throwing an extra 10 fish into the ocean and expecting to see a difference.
I love that analogy.
Could you provide any comment on the potential of using...
There is potential, and thank you, because you're touching on something that I didn't talk about. So there's the difference between biodiversity and function within the soil. So we do know certain fungi and certain bacteria do specific things. Nitrogen fixation in legumes is, we know that helps, right? That's you're putting nitrogen into the soil. Arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi, we know that certain species of those fungi will actually help particular crops. So in those particular cases, yes, addition of inoculum might help.
With the seed.
With the seed, exactly, because the issue is priority effects. So what's there usually tends to take over if you're adding inoculum into the soil onto a plant that's already growing, that might help for a year, that might help for that season, but that in most of the studies I've seen, that doesn't persist. So it is like throwing, 10 fish into the ocean. If they happen to be in the right place at the right time to have a positive effect, eventually they will swim away and you're going to have the exact same ocean in that little plot that you're looking at. If
so
that makes
potential,
sense.
But not just as a general thing, it'd be pretty focused.
There is potential, but I'm afraid to make promises, basically, because unfortunately soil is still quite a black box in the sense that sometimes we don't know why things don't work. If it works in the lab, if I have a mycorrhizal fungi and it's helping a wheat plant, what happens if I take that into the field? Oftentimes, I don't see the same effect in the field. So we have a lot of translation problems with the things that I do, unfortunately. And that's why I would say it's a bit too early to say. So that's different. That's functional, right? So biodiversity, in this case, why I'm interested in that is for the the soil organic matter and the soil organic carbon and sequestering carbon, because the more steps we have, the more cycles within the soil, the more a thing eats a thing eats a thing, the more opportunity there is to form that recalcitrant carbon that's going to stay, that you're going to be able to detect with your tests to say that there's more carbon in the soil. How quickly can we go back? Great question. I don't know of any studies that have looked at that, but that is actually something I really want to look at. And I'm really happy to be in Lethbridge because they actually have long-term trials of, from 1910, basically when they broke ground. And what they have there is the original native prairie soil. So they have soil samples from 1910. Mm-hmm. So during my interview, I got to hold a soil from 1910, which was just kind of amazing. The project that I'm working on is to use forensic methods. So to be able to find the trace DNA in the soils to hopefully get a profile to answer your question. So I'd like to answer that question. I don't think it's been done yet. There's always a resident population, right? Anywhere we look in soil, there's a pile of, there's a pile of bacteria at least. Fungi need structure and need a bit more time, right? So bacteria are the quick eaters, usually, and then fungi are more on the order of weeks, right? So they're just a different lifestyle.
Alrighty, so my first question about Monica's presentation is one about pronunciation. Is it fungi or fungi? Because I can't keep it straight or get it straight.
I think this is a very tomato, tomato, potato, potato pronunciation thing. As far as I can tell, the American pronunciation is different than the British pronunciation, and we always fall somewhere in the middle in Canada. So I don't think that you're super wrong in any of the pronunciations. It's more important to know what it is than to pronounce it properly.
Fair enough. I was hoping to get a bit more clarity there. But sorry about that. One thing I'd like to know from your perspective, what did you feel were the main messages from Monica's presentation?
I think Monica's presentation was really talking about how her research in her PhD thesis in looking at how plants communicate and how they exchange nutrients using mycorrhizal fungi. I'm going to go with that pronunciation. Is how it works and how she's been able to look at that so far and how she's working to apply it to cropping and food production systems, both perennial and annual cropping.
Okay, cool. Now, it was a lot of complicated science in that presentation. So we're just kind of, I guess we're going to break down the parts that I was really confused on.
Okay.
So at one point, Monica mentioned, I think it's called lignin and cellulose. She mentioned these are types of carbon that are stable. There are also types of carbon that are more, and I don't know if I'm going to pronounce this right, recalcitrant. Thank you. Okay. So first of all, what does recalcitrant mean and how does this all apply to soil carbon sequestration?
Recalcitrant is actually defined as stubborn. So it means so it just means it's a more it's a harder to break down. So the labile carbon pool is one that cycles really quickly, and so it comes in and out of the soil, whereas the recalcitrant carbon cycle stays there. And that's really what we want to look at when we're looking at carbon sequestration, soil carbon sequestration, because it's not the stuff that's just going to come into the soil and go back out as CO2 off of the microbes are going to respire it back out into the atmosphere, because that's not really helping with climate change.
Right. I know I've had that problem myself talking to folks about soil carbon sequestration, because you have those people arguing like it just cycles back up. It's not doing anything. I'm like, well, not quite. Like, yeah, there is a bunch that goes back up, but then you have that stuff that's really deep in the ground and it helps a lot with soil fertility.
Yeah. Yeah.
When Monica was talking, she also mentioned what's happening in the soil when, I guess, soil carbon is being created. But the thing that confused me, so I'm hearing like bacteria is eating bacteria, bacteria is eating fungi, fungi is eating bacteria, and this all creates biomass. But I guess in my logic brain, it doesn't. Things are getting eaten. Nothing's being built up. I don't know if you can explain this one to me.
Okay, so if you look at it more like those are mini life cycles. So every bacteria that's getting eaten by another bacteria and then eaten by a fungi, that those are, there's like kind of, so to speak, dead bodies that are being built up. So if you've got, like, you think about if you had a population of, and it's a terrible example because you don't want to use people and it sounds awful about people eating people. But if you're like, that's generations and generations and generations. So if you look at the soil kind of like a graveyard of bodies, and yeah, those things are being broken down, but there's like, you think about our bones and how long that would really take to break down in soil. And the bacterial bodies are not, they're not as kind of complex or hard to break down as our bones are, but there are, that's the cellulose, there's elements of their bodies that are harder to break down. And so the more you have of them and the more cycling there's happening, there is kind of like a graveyard effect, and that's where you're going to get more carbon. And also when we look at how when you get more complex, so you start with a bacterial cycle in soil, and as it gets more complex, that's when you get different types of bacteria and you get into fungi. And when that starts to happen, you get these glues that basically start connecting the carbon to parts of the soil and minerals and that kind of stuff, and that creates really stable carbon aggregates. And that is a lot of why it becomes more recalcitrant, is because it's kind of glued together and that makes it stable.
Okay, that actually leads right into my next question, because when she was talking about this long-term stable carbon, she mentioned its cell walls binding with minerals in the ground. So I can't figure out, is the action of that happening that creates the carbon, or that you just mentioned the glue part? So yeah, where's the stable carbon in all this?
Where's the stable carbon? When you're taking cellulose walls and you're binding them to other elements, that's how you're creating stability. So they're like soil carbon or soil aggregates just means clumps, basically.
Okay.
And so as stuff is clumping, that's the stickiness is also a thing that makes that carbon not taste as good to the other microbes. So they're not able to, that clump kind of stays as a clump because the other microbes aren't just going to eat that carbon and respire it back out as CO2. So the more clumps you get and the more glue you have, the more there's just some carbon that gets left alone and stays in the soil.
Could we almost say that stable carbon is like bad tasting carbon?
To the microbes, yeah.
I never thought of that way before. Okay. Last question about Monica's presentation is at the very end, like, it was more in the Q&A actually. Somebody asked a question about inoculants to help this process. She kind of gave it mixed reviews. I'm just wondering if you had a take on it.
Well, I think what she was really good about explaining is that if you are planting a seed and it needs to associate with a certain bacteria or a certain fungi to really thrive, it's probably useful because you want to have those pieces together. You want it to be as accessible as possible. It's like a woman taking multivitamins or prenatal vitamins when she's pregnant. You know, because you're doing something and you're growing a new life, you really want all the nutrients you can have in that context. And so it makes sense. And like one of the guys on the recording said, it's like putting 10 more fish in the sea. And she said, yeah, that's true. But if those 10 more fish are right by your hook and you catch them, that's a lot more fish. That could be good. You know, if they've gone away from where you need them to be, that's not helpful. And so I think it's really about getting the right inoculums for the right species of seeds that you're planting and making sure that there's also other conditions that are making sure that those microbes are going to associate with the plant as best as possible, because that will help it move forward. It's just, I think there's been a thing where we've sold, like, sometimes you think of inoculum, it's bacteria. And so it's, you think of your probiotics in the fridge, you keep them in the fridge to make sure they're still good. And sometimes inoculums are not treated with that same kind of respect that we would a probiotic. And so you want to look at how it's being stored and also if it is the right strain of microbe for the plant you're planting.
Okay. So it's definitely like, it's not going to hurt, but it could definitely help. And it's sort of more like, I don't know, how do you maximize this, I guess?
I think that you just, yeah, it's how you're handling it and how you're, you know, what's the medium you're using to put the inoculum on. And just being very like kind of, I guess it, I hate to say this, but like buyer beware of if someone's saying like, oh, you just need this and it's all going to be perfect. And you really need to understand how it fits into the broader microbial community of what you're trying to do, because it's always complex. It's always what we're trying to do with microbes is always really develop these complex interactive systems. And you don't just get that with one strain of microbe with a seed. Like I think we're always a bit in between paradigms, because conventional agriculture has come from this space where you need this, you do this. Like it's an A plus B equals C. And really, when you start working in a more ecological context, it's so infinitely complex, and you're just trying to build complex systems that balance themselves out. And that's the challenge of where we're sitting. And like Monica said, soil is still a black box. We don't know we still only know 20% of the microbes in soil. So let alone knowing if we don't even know what 80% is, let alone knowing what that 80% is actually doing and what their function is, that's when it gets really complex.
Oh, definitely. And sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but it almost seems like there's a bit of a matchmaking component to that you do with your inoculant. You got to match it to the right bacteria that you're either trying to help out or the right bacteria that's in your soil.
Yeah,
It's kind of like Tinder in a way. When
you think of it. You need complex algorithms.
but this does, not the Tinder comment, but another thing you said actually reminded me. Another thing Monica mentioned in her presentation that I kind of got, she's talking about biodiversity above ground means biodiversity below ground. I understand how that applies to plants. So different plants above ground are going to have different roots below ground. I don't understand how that applies to like the soil microbial world. I was wondering if you could explain that to me.
Yeah, for sure. Because different plants associate with different microbes. So a legume, which is a nitrogen-fixing bacteria that it associates with, and you have these nodules, those bacteria do not associate with grasses. And so that if you have no legumes in the system, you have no nitrogen-fixing bacteria.
Right.
And ditto with different like phosphorus solubilizing bacteria. Different plants will attract those or will support those types of bacteria. And then moreover, you really want to look at the bacteria that supports mycorrhizal fungi, which is what Monica did her PhD thesis in, because that develops almost like an internet communication and nutrient exchange superhighway in between all the plants in the soil and or all the plants, yeah, in the system. And so without that highway, like you can have all these microbes, but you're not going to get the efficient exchange back and forth. And so only certain plants associate with mycorrhizal fungi. So canola, for instance, does not. And so you're never going to get in all the yellow fields you see driving around Alberta in the summer, there's no mycorrhizal or very little that's going to be supported by that plant. So if you looked at intercropping another plant that does associate with mycorrhizal, it would actually probably strengthen the nutrient delivery mechanism to the canola by way of having more diversity in the system.
Okay. I was just in a training on facilitation the other night, and they were saying, you know, what does facilitation mean to you? And me and Christine Campbell from Alice, we're mm-hmm. both in the same workshop. And I said to her, it's mycorrhizal fungi. That's what it is. But I realized everybody else in the workshop would have no idea what I'm talking about because everybody was from Calgary. Like, there weren't any farmers in the group. But yeah, I kind of see what you're saying, like that super highway there. I like that. Up next, we're going to listen to what Doug Gray has to say about soil carbon sequestration on agricultural land. Now, what I really liked about Doug's presentation is he had a very, I guess, unique perspective, because he talked about carbon sequestration from the perspective of his ranch, like starting with his grandfather all the way up to what's going on right now. You've known Doug for quite some time. What's it like working with Doug?
Doug's amazing because he's a really good storyteller and he's really good at encompassing complex interactions and conversations and both with people and information into this like very measured but inspiring story.
I think it's a great way to put it. Yeah, actually, we're going to get a little taste of Doug's sense of humor as soon as the presentation begins. I kind of like how you cracked a joke right at the beginning.
So we're 20 minutes behind and they're giving me the mic. What are the chances we're going to catch up? That last slide that was up there of the carbon map was what started my conversation with Kimberly at the conference in Edmonton. I went by her booth and saw that map and stopped. And when I figured out that was carbon, this is exactly what we need, you know. And I'll get to it as we go through this. So I'm going to give you a brief history. We're going to go through a lot of slides in a big hurry here, but it'll sort of give you a sense of how I got mixed up in this game. And you can, those of you who are ranching or farming can sort of do your comparables where you sit and how it relates to you. But it'll give you an idea of why I'm standing here right now. So just like all the rest of you, we started off with this as a resource. Almost 10,000 years of prairie in this Palliser Triangle. And so that's all of our baseline in the sense of that's where we came from. And just as a point of reference, we're just outside of the Calgary dot there in thin black Chernozemic soil is where we are. Those color differences are probably by and large rainfall differences. You know, you get more rain. There's some soil samples here. There's one from Olds. Well, it's got more black topsoil. Why? More rain. It's almost a way of confirming that over a long time period. So, you know, the buffalo roamed the prairie and then they got taken out. Good thing, just imagine if back in 1880 or 1875 you had to have a royal commission to decide whether you could kill all the buffalo or not. And then whether farmers could till the soil. I don't think we'd have a country here if we had to go through that. So the buffalo got replaced for about 25 or 30 years with cattle on the landscape. And you know, they brought cattle in from the U.S. initially in big herds, and the ranchers would go east and go to England and Europe and get money and finance it, and then they would bring some cattle in, and ranching replaced. See if I figure out how this works. It's okay. And ranching replaced the buffalo for a short period of time. And then in early 1900s, in our case 1910, my grandfather came to the land base we're on now and did this. So as we all know, the carbon started to leave town. And the whole prairies fell under this dynamic. And as equipment improved, they got better at it. And tillage was the primary tool at the time. And these guys were doing what they thought was the best they could do in most cases. That's not me on that tractor, but I watched a neighbor do exactly that thing. Pull a one-way disc with at about 6 miles an hour, and the dust just flying. And of course, when the rain didn't come and the wind did, you know, we ended up with problems. So, but this tillage agriculture worked. My grandfather came in 1910. This picture's taken about 1950. You know, they exported, Canada became the breadbasket of the world. We sent wheat and beef and other agriculture products all over the world, and made a lot of money, and that money coming back in paid for those roads, that power line, the schools, the hospitals, the infrastructure. It paid for everything. So this worked. It was successful. My grandfather's, he had 9 kids and they all got land. He accumulated enough land, they all got some. It all, you know, it, and so his plan was very successful, but it came at some costs. You know, I'm old enough to remember those dust storms when we, you know, the land was half or 30% summer fallow, when we tilled it every spring, and if it got dry and the wind rolled, you know, that's what you'd get. And that picture of the water isn't actually from our place, but it could be at various times when you get a lot of snow runoff or a lot of rain in a hurry. So those were consequences. And, you know, we got better and bigger equipment, and we could do more of it. So tillage and fallow and bare ground were the norm. And so we went from this to where my grandfather, my father, and me for almost 20 years took half the organic matter out of that. But it worked. We made money doing it, right? So it was... that was the engine to, and I, one of the turning points for me is I read a book written by Montgomery, Soils, The Erosion of Civilizations, Chronicles. You should read that book, Chronicles. You know, the Romans, you get a soil where you can grow something, and so you do, and you end up with more people right away because you got more food. Agriculture started 10,000 years ago or 8,000 years ago in Syria. It took them 5,000 years to trash that soil, but they did it. What's Syria look like today? You know, the Roman Empire, by the time they were done, they were importing most of their food from North Africa. At one time, you could travel across North Africa in the shade, believe it or not. So our history is let's grow, let's do the next thing. The best thing for next year. And we do more of this. And we took half the organic matter out of the soil. So we ended up in a scenario where my dad had retired. My brother had gone back to work off the farm. Our 3 kids had moved away. And Linda and I were left with, how are we going to keep this thing going? So we had to make some changes. So we decided, after joining Foothills Forage and going to a Jim Bauer pasture school, my first introduction into this kind of thing, and then ranching for profit, we made the switch from a mixed farming operation. We went to a forage-focused ranching operation. And we took this land base that's in that, those red lines there, and seeded everything that's in white there. You can take out this piece of ground. We rented it for a long time, don't anymore. But all the white area there is seeded, over 1,000 acres of tame grass, high legume tame pasture we seeded down, and made the judgment that probably 20-acre paddock would work okay. Turned out to be close enough to be pretty functional. So all those small, those are 20-acre paddocks pretty much. We seeded down high legume pastures, tried to get 50% legumes in those pastures when you seed them. This is 20 years ago we did this. We took water to the paddocks, put in pipelines so that there was water in the paddock. They weren't traveling a long way to get water. We learned over time, with help from guys like Jim, how to manage this grass. And our management, we were managing for the benefit of the grass. We let the grass take care of the cows, but we were focused on the grass. So we were cross-fencing and moving cattle every 2 or 3 days all summer long was our norm. We learned how to manage bloat on high legume pastures. They only die once. The worst morning was 5 cows. My kids were all with me. Pretty sobering. But, you know, as somebody, I heard somebody say one time, the rest of them were gaining an extra pound a day. So we got it back pretty quick. So we extended our grazing by having some pasture paddocks with crested wheatgrass in them. And the earliest, this is the 15th of April, 1 year. We actually had pears out on grass, 15th of April. It's a month later, the last 3 or 4 years. We haven't had the moisture to get there, but we tried to push that start to grazing forward. We've since moved our calving to the May 1st. We breed to calve May 1st, which means we get calves on the ground about the 22nd or 3rd of April. And we've done that to better suit our feed supply and how nature rolls on our place. So we're by and large calving on grass at this point in time. We learned to manage yearlings, to run yearlings. Had never done that before. And some summers moved the wire every day. This is my youngest daughter moving fence with yearlings on a daily move. Just trying to capture that energy from all that photosynthesis. We pushed our grazing back. We're trying to copy guys like John and guys in the foothills in southern Alberta. Where did the cattle go to start with? They went to the foothills in southern Alberta. Why? Because you could run them year-round with no equipment. So we're trying to copy that. So when we seeded down all that land to tame pastures, it freed up our native grass, and we found out that if we weaned in the first week in November, these cows could run on this native grass till the middle of January if the winter would allow it. So now we're grazing from, you know, if you want to take the extreme, we're on grass 15th of April. We're still on grass the middle of January, which is pretty good for this part of the country. So these cows have, we've figured out how to do this. We bale grazed. We bunch grazed, we swath grazed. Currently, swath grazing is our main strategy for the getting through the back half of the winter. We'll get on those swaths sometime in January, and they'll be there till they go to grass sometime in May. We learned to winter our calves on swaths, and we used some of Graham's introduced forages here to up the quality of the stand and get higher quality in there so we could winter those calves on swath grazing. You can winter a calf for 60 cents a day and get them to gain a pound a day. It's a pretty good way to get through the winter, and boy do they go when they get to grass or to the feedlot after that. So we were paying attention to what these pioneers like Neil Dennis and Gabe Brown and lots of others were doing and trying to figure out how that meshed with what's going on our place. pretty steep learning curve, always trying to figure it out. And over time, became more and more focused back on what was our initial resource. And I think one of the tipping points for me was, I can remember right where I was sitting in that room in Edmonton at that grazing conference, listening to Christine Jones from Australia talk about the liquid carbon pathway. And when I realized that those plants were spending 30% of the energy they garnered from the sun and pumping it out through their roots to enhance their own viability, they're not just sitting there taking what comes. They're fully engaged in the process. That was really a tipping point that we really had to start paying attention to what's going on underneath the ground. And we got to learn more and find out more. And that's where our focus probably should be. So, you know, that leads you down to the trail where soil health becomes the key to everything. If we got healthy soil, we'll grow healthy food. We'll have healthy livestock. We'll have healthy people. Great connection I think we can make. So, and really, we're in the energy business. Great, Alberta's in the energy business, right? We're in the energy business. We're taking that sunlight, and in our case, the only thing we market walks off our place on four legs. And maybe if we can sell some of that carbon, we'll find another market. But this is a highly complex thing. If you want to get some idea how complex, go have supper some night with Kimberly, and she can tell you about connecting those dots and how many long conversations and a lot of scientific reflection and whatnot on what actually is going on there. And it's a moving target. Who knew about mycorrhizal fungi 10 years ago and the fact that it helped plants talk to each other? Plants talk to each other. You know, the people that don't want to kill animals, what are they going to do when they find out the plants have feelings? And Dr. Henry Jansen gave a presentation at our AGM last spring, and this is one of his slides. And he talked about a river of sunlight flowing through the land. So a soil is healthy to the extent that it catalyzes and steers efficiently that stream of solar energy. Soil health. Fertility is the ability of soil to receive and store and release energy. That idea is as old as I am. And so you see on that top corner over there, soil carbon shows up. So I think that's why we're here today, because at the nub of all this, soil carbon. And then he also had another slide that put the ruminant livestock into that mix and how you get that recycling of nutrients and it empowers the whole system. And so I think for me, those were some pretty important slides. So my nephew Tim has come back to the ranch, and we're thrilled that it's, we've got the next generation involved. And so we start packing a shovel and looking at the soil and trying to figure out what we've got and what's going on, and going to classes and seminars and learning about regenerative systems. And really, this map was up at that conference in Edmonton. Here's what we're talking about. It's capturing sequestered carbon. And, you know, the information is just mushrooming. Who knew that one rye plant could have 377 miles of roots? Well, nobody 10 years ago. So our ability to see what's going on, understand what's going on in the soil has changed dramatically. Right, Jamili? Yes. I think it's just, can you keep up to the change?
It's kind of crazy.
It's a challenge, right? Yeah. Because there's just so much.
If you are able to stabilize the aggregates in the soil, you're going to be stabilizing their carbon. If you are able to do that, that carbon is going to stay there for many, many, many years.
So it's getting
the basic
Stable carbon there, yeah. So biodiversity, over and over again, we hear biodiversity is the pathway. So we're using livestock as a tool. We're trying to keep living roots on the soil. This is in our swath grazing. Those plants are still green. That would be about a month later than this last year. You know, we're trying to get eyes that can see the important things and enhance what's going on under that soil in order to get this kind of landscape and the productivity we need to carry on. So back to the soil thing then. We think, I have soil tests from 1985 on some of our land with organic matter as low as 2.3%. And I have, so this is where we took half the organic matter out of the soil from 1910 to roughly 1985. About that time we started direct one-pass seeding and stopped summer fallowing, and I think we kind of turned a corner there. We saw a lot more earthworm activity, was one indicator in our soil. And then in about 97, we turned another corner and put in all that perennial pasture. And now we've got soil tests that are in that 5 and 6% range. So I think we're going the right direction. When you saw that map of our place where it had the blue as opposed to the orange, I was really happy to see that, because that's some confirmation that somebody else has seen the same thing. So where's the value? Well, 1% of organic matter will hold 20,000 gallons, or about 3/4 of an inch of water in your soil. And organic matter improves infiltration. So if we're going to get crazier weather where we get a lot more water in shorter time periods and then none, the ability to capture water and hang on to it's important. And then, as Kimberly said earlier, the organic matter provides all sorts of plant nutrients and benefits that way. One of the indicators on our place, my kind of rough cowboy math, when we started out, we were at about 6 acres to run a cow and her replacement heifer. And now I think we're somewhere about 5.5. So either our cows got smaller or we got more productive. And it might be a little bit of both. It might be cows that are a little more suited because they've all grown up on the place and been selected because they work there. But I think we're also gaining in our productivity. And then 1% of organic matter on an acre is about 18 tons of carbon equivalent. Is that, can you confirm that? You're in that game.
I'm sorry, I cannot confirm that. I can confirm the price.
That's what my Google research found, was 18 tons of carbon equivalent out of 1% organic matter. So at $30 a ton, $540 an acre, well, I think, you know, we've got conservatively a 2-3% bump on 1,000 acres. So you can run the math. So when John says he's just about the point where he's ready to pay to get the measurement, you can see where there's some value there. So, and we're not going back. We're not putting a plow in it again. No, but you know, that conversation is real, because my daughter's married to a family down at Seven Persons, and they're really wondering about those guys that are tilling up. They're putting native prairie into cultivation, and no penalty to do it. So if it's going to work one way, it's got to work the other way. So this, I've kind of got to the place where I think I've been in enough carbon sequestration, carbon offset discussions that I think a whole farm measurement might be easier to pull off than a landscape offset. You know, the no-till guys have a landscape offset. They're getting a couple bucks an acre because they're no-till. So some guys might create $20 of value, but you got to draw the line so everybody's at least over the bar. So it ends up at $2, which is almost here nor there. Yeah, so, but I think if we go to a whole farm, now you got to have the right kind of farm. If you're going to set stock your cattle and just put them out there on a section of land at a time and leave them for the summer and not manage it, that's not going to get you where you want to go. So when we decided to go ranching and put it all into grass, I decided that I had to manage that with every bit as much intensity as my grain farming neighbor was managing his canola and his wheat. So it's not a laid-back process. It's an all-in. You know, we're moving cattle every 2 or 3 days, and we're thinking about it 24/7. That's how you get there. And I think there's lots of people in the room can relate to that. And thank goodness Tim's come back. He's got skills I don't have. And he's helping move us forward on that. So these carbon, doing that whole farm measurement, is, as Kim talked about, is expensive, but there's potential benefits. And then if you think about tying up that much carbon and moving the atmospheric carbon down, if that's where society wants to go, there's social benefits as well. So, and really, at the end of it, we're trying to leave a legacy for the future and have the next generation, give the next generation an opportunity to do what we love to do.
Okay. So, from your perspective, Kim, and Doug's presentation, what were some of the main messages that stuck out?
I think the main messages had a lot to do with how we treat the land has to do with our best understanding of what of the information available at the time. And so we're always trying to do our best, but when we have new understanding, it means we have to change our practices to come up to meet that understanding.
That's a great way to put it. Okay. Now, Doug's presentation, he mentioned that getting carbon measured on your land, it could be quite expensive. Can you give us any, like, how expensive are we talking here?
It really depends. And historically, it's been quite expensive because in order to ensure we had enough measurements, we had to use a grid system at fairly regular intervals. And so that was a lot of labor that went into pulling the soil cores and also a lot of lab processing to do that. And so what we're working on with Food Water Wellness and Pachetere is a system that uses satellite imagery to optimize the sampling. So it reduces the amount of sampling points required because it uses the satellite imagery to best represent the landscape conditions. And so it drops the amount of cores that have to be pulled and the amount of lab work that has to be done. But still to this level of the scientifically rigorous level that we want to see so that it's kind of bulletproof in terms of, or it's not going to be questioned, and it can set up a system that could actually set up the basis for an offset, a carbon offset in a compliance market.
Okay. No, obviously we definitely need something like that right now too. But like currently, if somebody wanted to get carbon measured on their land, do you have an idea?
I think if we were going to do it through commercial means, it would be, I've heard farmers get quotes of $250,000. I've gotten quotes of $58,000. But what we're really trying to do with Pachetere is to get funding together to make it free for like to have no upfront costs for farmers to get their land measured. And then the hope is that once we get the system in place, that we'd be able to recover the cost of testing through the sale of offsets.
One thing Doug also mentioned in the presentation was he's an advocate of whole farm carbon measurement as opposed to landscape measurement. I don't quite understand what the difference is.
He actually says the difference between whole farm measurement versus landscape offsets.
Ah, Wasn't listening.
Okay. So the what he's talking about is, so a landscape offset is based on a study that's been done, and there's a number of sites. Usually 60 is considered enough to be statistically relevant, and they've measured. They've gone out onto these sites, they've done measurement, and they create a coefficient based on a whole bunch of landscape and environmental conditions. And then from that coefficient, a number that's kind of the average, they use a conservative estimate of that. And that number becomes the amount that farmers get paid for doing a practice, like no-till cropping. So that's a landscape offset. What we're talking about doing, and what Doug's really excited about, is a farm scale carbon measurement, where we go and draw the boundaries using GPS on the map, and take out the appropriate amount of samples for that area, and then are able to calculate and map the carbon distribution on the landscape. And then we would do that again at a reasonable amount of time, 3 to 5 to 7 years, depending on moisture, to be able to see what the difference is and to see if there's been a difference in carbon distribution and there's been an increase or a decrease in the total amount of carbon on landscape. Not on the farm, not on the landscape.
Be careful.
Gotta be careful.
Right. You mentioned actually moisture there. You said like it depends on moisture. What does moisture have to do with any of this?
When things are dry, when things are wet and warm, you get lots of bacterial activity. And that's why your hockey bag stinks. Not that saying that you have a hockey bag or that it stinks, but most hockey bags stink because they are.
If I had a hockey bag, I'm sure it would stink.
When it's wet and warm, you get a proliferation of microbes. And when it's dry, microbes just don't like that environment as well as when it's moist. So you're going to get a higher level, and you're also going to get more plant growth. You're going to get more photosynthesis. Moisture is a limiting capacity on plant growth and microbial growth.
Okay. I know this is kind of a whole other issue, but does that mean certain parts of Alberta then would be better at sequestering carbon than other parts? Like, you know, closer to the foothills, I guess they get a bit more moisture that way. Down south, they might have a bit more trouble.
Yes, absolutely. And it's, I think that that's what, like even with the offset system that we have a drier area that it gets half as much carbon offset credit as the parkland. So it's double. And that's, again, those are large coefficients and large generalizations. But even from farm to farm, you are going to have a different number potentially if there's a microclimate or something like that. So, you know, but like places where there's irrigation, that's another opportunity that they have to use the moisture that they are bringing in to be sequestering carbon.
Okay, so it's not like a completely like a lost cause. It is something that could happen in other parts of Alberta, or all parts of Alberta, I should say. It really depends on your management practices.
It does. Yeah.
Okay. Oh, cool. And Doug also brought up Christine Jones' liquid carbon pathway. Now, is that the same as that superhighway you were talking about, or is this something different?
It's a little bit different. When she's talked about the liquid carbon pathway, she's really talking about the CO2 that gets broken down through photosynthesis. And so the oxygen gets released, and then the plant has 30% of that CO2, it uses a bunch of it to build its body, but about 30% of it actually kind of works almost like sap in a tree, and it comes down through the plant and is it's exuded through the roots.
I hate that word.
Exuded.
It's worse than recalcitrant.
It's up there in one of those words. It just sounds weird to say it. So that is actually, it's a root exudate, or it's just dripped out of the bottom of the roots to feed the microbes. And so that is where it interfaces with the superhighway, because it's that liquid carbon that starts feeding the mycorrhizal. And the mycorrhizal uses that as currency that's the below ground carbon economy, that the plants are trading that carbon for other nutrients they need.
Makes sense. And that also sounds very similar. Didn't Christine Nichols do something about currency trading? That I'm daring you to... No, you don't have to do it. Maybe you should explain. We had Christine Nichols, who used to be the chief scientist at the Rodale Institute. She actually Skyped in for the workshop, and she did this really, really amazing, impressive thing during the workshop. I'm not going to make Kim do it, but Kim, if you want to explain what she did, you can try if you'd like.
We've been calling it her auctioneer speech, because she does it so quick and using such technical scientific terms that it kind of makes everybody's head hurt. And I think she's doing that to make the point that it is infinitely complex what's happening in the soil. But it's basically the idea that you've got this carbon coming in, and then the plant says to the mycorrhizal fungi, I need phosphorus. And so the mycorrhizal fungi says, okay, if you give me this amount of carbon, I'll go to the phosphorus solubilizing bacteria and I'll get that, but it's going to need, it needs to get paid in carbon. And so it says, okay, yeah, that's no problem, because I've got all these leaves and this leaf surface, so I'm doing lots of photosynthesis, it's no big deal. And so then it's like, then the plant says to the, oh, wait, I think I'm kind of need some nitrogen. And so it says, oh, the mycorrhizal fungi says, okay, I'll go get you some nitrogen. And it goes and gets it from some bacteria. And then and it kind of like quenches its thirst. And then a little bit later, it's like, oh, I'm going to grow. I need like a lot of nitrogen. And it says, okay, I'll go over there to that legume and I'll get you some, like a whole bunch of nitrogen. And we're going to use those nitrogen fixing bacteria, but they need a lot of carbon, because we know that when we try to manufacture nitrogen fertilizers, it takes a lot of energy, power, carbon to do that. And it's no different in a natural system. And so, but exactly at that moment, if there's a cow or a hay, like all of a sudden, that plant loses its leaf surface and it can no longer photosynthesize and it doesn't have its solar panels anymore, then the mycorrhizal has to say, sorry, I can't get you the nitrogen you need because you're not going to give me the carbon. And it just is the way, it's a currency exchange, just like we can't go to the grocery store and just get food unless we have money.
Holy crap, you did it. Doug talked about organic matter, mm-hmm. and he was saying that his organic matter has gone up about 5 or 6%. What I'm wondering, and we talked about this yesterday, just saying that, you know, I'm a fairly cheap guy. You know, I drive a car that's about 18 years old. I'm a farmer. I don't want to pay the, like, it was close to $250,000 or whatever to get these measurements done until Pachaterra, you know, gets everything going for us. So if I don't want to pay that money, can I just use that percentage of organic matter to determine how much carbon I have in my soil?
Absolutely, you can, if you're doing it for feedback on your management practices. If you're looking at how to sell carbon offsets into a compliance-based market or even a voluntary market, that's where you need the much more beefy version of it. And I think that, you know, what Doug was talking about in his presentation is that that carbon map that we're looking at producing for each individual farm, it just gives a whole nother level of understanding of the distribution of the carbon on the landscape and gives you like more clues as to where you may be losing carbon or areas where you'd want to look at implementing a practice that could really build carbon, like bale grazing or something like that.
Okay. At one point in the recording, you can hear Yamili Zavala. I hope I said her last name.
Zavala,
okay. Who is a soil health and crop management specialist who works. She works for CARA, right?
Yeah, the Chinook Applied Research Association.
Excellent, thank you. And one thing that she said that really stuck out in my mind was, if you can stabilize the aggregates in your soil, you can stabilize the carbon in the soil. So it feels like a very profound statement, but I don't fully understand it. I was wondering if you could just explain that one for me.
It really picks up on the theme of what we were talking about in Monica's presentation. So creating those soil aggregates through the development of complex microbial interactions, and getting those glues there, that's how you're going to create those aggregates or clumps. And so that's going to make the carbon more stable. The fun part about it too, it's also going to increase your water infiltration. So when we see in the spring, when you drive past a field and there's just water sitting in the field, that's an indication that there isn't very good infiltration because there isn't good soil aggregate stability, because it's just turning into mud and the clay and everything is just like holding the water on the top instead of letting it infiltrate.
Okay, so actually boosting the soil carbon, it actually really helps for, I guess, water catchment or water infiltrating your soil.
Exactly. If you think about one of the most carbon-based pieces of everyday material we have around is cardboard. And so if you think about what cardboard's like when it gets wet, it holds water like nobody's business. And there's all those surfaces and those that the interspace in the car, the cardboard is such a great place to hold water and all that surface area. And that's exactly what carbon does, increasing the carbon in the soil.
Doug also mentioned in his presentation that we're in the energy business here in Alberta. And he was making a reference to the oil and gas sector, but he really was talking about soil, because he said fertility is the ability of soil to receive, store, and release energy. What do you think about the comment?
I think it's very profound. I think that if you look at even oil and gas, that is energy from the sun that has gone through a photosynthetic process that was captured through photosynthesis and now has been fossilized. So we have all of these deposits of energy that are just old sunlight. And what Doug's talking about is in farming and ranching, we're doing the same thing, but we're doing it with real-time sunlight. And we've got this great opportunity, depending on how much we maximize the photosynthesis and also support it by creating conditions for the microbes to continue the process below the ground. We're in the energy business. We're maximizing the solar radiation and turning it into energy, which also turns into food.
Sounds like everybody wins, really. Another thing I really liked about Doug's presentation is, there was no crap. Like, he was very, very honest about it. Like, when tillage came up, he didn't lie. Like, he's not a tillage guy at all, but he said, you know, tillage worked. It worked for my grandfather. It worked for my father. Perhaps even at one point in his farming career, it worked for him. And he started going into a bit more history, talking about the examples of like Syria and Rome, how it took just like centuries for them to mine all of the carbon out of their soil, then creating a very problematic situation for them towards the end of their day. And this is a really long way of me getting around to asking is, does soil carbon sequestration have an effect on the here and now? Or is it really only going to have an impact centuries from now?
I think it definitely has an impact right now. We are facing a climate crisis. I think there has been enough literature to support that at this point. I know there's some people that aren't 100% convinced about that. But whether you're convinced of the climate crisis or not, there's so many benefits to soil carbon sequestration and increasing the carbon in soil. Like I just mentioned, the water holding capacity, I keep mentioning the complexity of the microbes. Well, that is also creating pest resistance and all sorts of balancing. Like it's like your gut. When you have a healthy microbial system in your body, then you don't get one bacteria taking over. So you have a better immune system, and that's what happens in the soil as well. And so there's so many mechanisms that give us an opportunity to have better food security and better food sustainability and sustainability of farming and ranching as an entire industry through soil carbon sequestration. And I think that you know, Franklin D. R. Roosevelt's quote about the nation that destroys its soil destroys itself is really present. And, you know, going back to what I said about my what I felt Doug's presentation was about is when we have a different understanding, we have to shift our practices to reflect how that understanding. But before we understood how important soil carbon was and how important it was to keep as much of it in the soil and work to increase it as opposed to just mining it, which is what we were doing through tillage, that we have to adjust our practices to reflect the understanding.
Last question. You've been working in the egg scene in Alberta for, you know, a few years now, longer than I have. So you've got quite a bit more experience. So I'm just wondering your personal opinion. Are we making any progress here? Have we turned things around? Are we really starting to build soil carbon again?
I think we are. I think it's still not at the level that we need it to be to really make huge impacts. But we've got to look at the kind of the carrots that we can present and the understanding and knowledge that needs to be disseminated to make that possible. But when I took my first soil health workshop, it was in 2011, and it was in a Quonset, and there was about 30 people in the class. In 2015, we had the first soil health conference in Edmonton, and there was 400, and people were like fighting to get in. There was a wait list, and it was just like this tight moment. And I was like, whoa, this is, and I remember sitting there thinking, this is exactly the stuff that I learned 10 years ago. But now there's a whole chunk of the ranching community and farming community in Alberta that's like, this isn't this little enclave of people that are thinking this way. 2 years later, they had another conference and they increased the capacity and it was still sold out. People were still like, you know, trying to sneak in almost to get to that workshop. And that to me is really demonstrative of the fact that we are making serious gains in our knowledge of soil health and how that interfaces with soil carbon sequestration and how that interfaces with changing management practices. Rural Routes to Climate Solutions is a Central Alberta-based project empowering rural Albertans with climate solutions. Along with producing this podcast, we run workshops and farm field days. Our next workshop is on how to create your own farmers cooperative. For more information about the workshop and Rural Routes to Climate Solutions, go to the website at rr2cs.ca. We'd like to thank Doug Ray and Monica Gorzlak for allowing us to use their presentations to make this episode, and the Alberta Real Estate Foundation for providing financial support for the podcast. Today's episode was recorded at Media Lab YYC, and Kieran Mountain of Mountain Media in Red Deer took care of the post-production editing. The Advisory Committee of Rural Routes to Climate Solutions is made up of Brenda Barrett, Dana Penrice, Mark Fox, and Kim Cornish. We act mainly as Derek's sounding board and make sure he doesn't do anything too crazy. Happy farming wherever you are in Alberta, and remember, what's good for the farm is usually good for the climate.